The rain in Spain falls mainly in the plain.
1, 2, 3.
5, 6, 7.
Welcome to the Getting Simple Podcast. Getting Simple is about simplifying your life and doing less better. Hi, everyone. This is Nono Martinez Alonso, and this is the second episode of the Getting Simple podcast. Before we get started, I'm going to give you a brief introduction of what Getting Simple is. So Getting Simple is about simplifying your life, about trying to do less things, but do them better. And I understand it as a journey to a simpler and more balanced life. In the essays I write and publish on the gettingsimple.com website, I talk about specific aspects that I believe can make our lives better. In this podcast, I'll interview people to see how certain ways of living improve their life quality, and discuss with them the impacts of the adoption of certain routines and habits in their daily lives. So without further ado, let's start with the interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everyone. So this is the second episode of the Getting Simple podcast. Today is 18th of December of 2017, and I'm really glad to be here in Boston, Massachusetts, with Zach Cron from Autodesk.
Hi, everyone. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so he's a colleague of mine currently. I'm working here also in Boston. And we're basically just going to be having a chat about life habits, simplicity, or like any other geeky things.
Sounds
like technology. So first, if you can start telling us something about yourself, like just as a brief introduction, I would say that Zach is a senior product manager here at Autodesk, working with the Dynamo development team.
Yep.
And that he's been basically focused for the last 10 years in developing parametric design tools and technologies for builders and architects to basically to make their lives a bit easier.
Yeah, so I'm a architect and designer by training. I tell people that I'm a recovering architect a lot. I worked in the architecture industry for about 8 years before moving over into the software world and working with Autodesk. Before that, I was actually a very analog person. So sort of the transition into sort of a fully digital world has been sort of part of a very large and shallow arc.
Okay, so and this transition that you mentioned, how long, so what range of years did you kind of suffer this transition?
So I joined Autodesk about 10 years ago, and I came in working with the quality assurance group. So I had been working at a bridge design office where we did sort of the conceptual work for landmark bridges. And I had had a bunch of conversations with people who I had known from school and from other parts of life who had had some experience with working on Revit, which is, you know, building information modeling, sort of industry standard tool for making buildings. And they had all come from the architecture world and had said, hey, you know, we've been working with this interesting tool. And basically there's this job where you can go over and you sort of act like an architect, but the job is to try and break the software and get feedback from it. And that sounded pretty interesting. So that was where I sort of took the plunge into sort of the fully digital world. Before that, a lot of work that I had done was working in digital modeling tools and CAD applications, but I had gotten pretty disappointed with the way that most of the work was involved in making drawings and then making models that match the drawings and making drawings that match the models and sort of chasing your tail sort of between these sort of documentation practices. And it just seemed like there was a better way to work that would sort of simplify things down. And that was sort of how I got involved with building information modeling and with Autodesk in general. And from there, it was just sort of a strange and windy road through sort of banging on applications with a stick all day to make them break, and then talking about that experience. And I did a lot of sort of writing and teaching at that same time, and it started to sort of migrate into something where I was spending a lot more time talking to architects and designers and engineers and taking their requests back in for discussions with development and people who are actually writing the code.
Okay, because you were actually involved in like Boston area architectural projects, right? You were working for a bit, or I mean, how many years?
Yeah, so in the Boston scene, I worked at three different firms over the course of 8 years. And then before that, I was in graduate school. And before that, I spent a bunch of time working for large-scale sculptural artists and people who were involved in sort of performance to help sort of construct and design and fabricate the things that they were imagining.
And if we jump into today, what does your day-to-day look like?
Let's see, day-to-day. One of the really cool things is that it looks very different every day. It can be a little frustrating because very often I get to the end of the day and I didn't do any of the things that I thought I was going to do. But usually it's because I got distracted by things that are really, really interesting. So most of the time I come in the morning and I generally have maybe a half dozen conversations with developers and designers here at the office who are looking for a little bit more direction or explanation of the intentions behind different projects that we're doing. So, you know, if somebody is building a new way to deliver the software, they would like to sort of get a little bit more feedback about, you know, who is supposed to be receiving the stuff that we're making, or if somebody is looking at the particular behavior of some logic in an application that we're writing. People generally want to talk a little bit about, is this the right behavior? Is this not the right behavior? Is this what customers are going to expect from this stuff to work? So there's a lot of that just sort of in the very beginning of the day. A lot of the rest of the day is actually in coordination with other groups. So our group in the compute group makes a number of different things. One of them is Dynamo, which is a visual programming application. And there's a lot of other groups at Autodesk who are looking at using some of the tools. So sorry, I'm talking a lot with my hands here, and it's not coming across on radio. So there's a lot of other groups that are looking to use the tools that we make. So a lot of the time is talking with those different groups, everything from getting into the weeds of how do we implement these tools to conceptually, how do we even think about them? So there's a lot of those sorts of meetings. What I should be spending a lot of time on, and I don't spend as much time on, is actually doing things like road mapping documents where we say, this is where the application is going to be going over the course of a year.
So the next question I wanted to ask you is that if you have one, what would you say is your mission or the contribution at a higher level that you want to make on the design field, or that you think the job that you have right now can lead you to help?
Well, sort of on a large scale, I think it's a really exciting time to be working in design because there's a lot of tools that are coming into sort of mainstream use that really change the way that people think about doing design. And our group is, I think, a big part of that contribution. So in sort of specific terms, there's the traditional way of drawing that's been happening for thousands and thousands of years of people like putting marks on paper or communicating directly about saying, this is where I want this piece of a building to go, in discussion with people who are putting those pieces of buildings together. Very sort of explicit, I want this thing here, I want this thing here. Over the course of design history, you get a couple people at the top of that pyramid who get to make sort of the broad gestures about intention, saying, we need this kind of system to be implemented over this whole building. We need to have these kinds of forms implemented over the whole building. And what computational tools allow people to do is to be able to make those sort of big sort of principled decisions in design process that have lots and lots and lots of smaller implications throughout the whole design. But sort of people who aren't at the top of a human pyramid of labor now get to be able to make those decisions. What that looks like is an individual designer or a handful of designers can decide on things like, here's a proportional system that we want the entire building to be based on. And now we can actually instantiate all of the individual decisions that need to happen at every single point in the building, because we can describe that proportional system in such a way that we can execute it throughout an entire building. And that's a big part of what computational thinking and computational design is about. It's about being able to define your intentions in a way that a computer can execute those intentions rather than having to communicate those individually to individual actors. Yeah. So that's the big thing that I think that our group, is able to sort of contribute to the world right now, is that it's these are methods that have been around for a while, but we're trying to make them accessible to a lot more people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is pretty good is like this transition that you say you're doing, right? Like it, from getting more into technology that you were more analog before. I think it also is represented when you kind of leave architecture in some way, that these kind of hand-drawn CAD plans and things that are more, that resemble more to like hand sketching something and doing it manually, a process that if you do it twice with the same system, you're gonna have to still do manually, even if the rules are exactly the same that you have to apply. So in those terms, do you think that has made your job simpler? Or, I mean, it definitely makes it more efficient sometimes, but does it make it easier or simpler at some point, or at least for the people who use these tools?
Do these kind of tools make their lives simpler? Yes and no. I mean, in a lot of the times when we go out and we talk to customers about what we call sort of pain points in the way that they work, one of the things that we've zeroed in on a lot are saying, you know, if a person has to sit down and design a part of a building and it involves 1,000 columns, so I've got 1,000 columns and I need to add a specific piece of information to each column, that means that, you know, I can make the calculation. I can say, okay, I know that adding this information to this building element will take me 5 minutes per column, and I've got 1,000 columns. And so if I get started right now, I can add that piece of information, and by Friday, I can get my work done. On one level, that's a very complicated thing that a person has to do. On another, it's very simple. That human's life is, they've got this huge amount of work that they need to do ahead of them, but the execution of it is relatively simple. And on the software side, we look at that kind of process and say, that's horrible that somebody has to sit there and do this sort of manual process over and over and over again. And is there a way that we can make this simpler for them to do that, like quicker, easier? But generally what that means is that they have to change the way that they work, and they have to change the way that they think about the problem. And I think that we overestimate the value of efficiency in terms of our users' lives. So many people might see that problem of, I have to add this 5 minutes of information to the column for an entire week in order to get my job done. But on the other hand, they come in, they put on their headphones, they sit in front of the computer, and they groove out to their music for a week in something that's a predictable, reliable process where they can get their work done and know that it'll happen by the end of the week. What we try and offer is to say, if you change the way you work and you do a bunch of intentional work at the beginning of that, and you say, I'm going to understand what the patterns are of the kind of things that I need to do, the kind of information that I need to add to these columns. I need to add, you know, what row it's on and what floor it's on to each one of the columns, for instance. But if I think through what the process is and what the logic of that is, I can execute that really fast. I don't know if that makes their lives simpler or better. We've assumed for a long time that it does.
Yeah, I think this discussion is a bit like, if you can do what you used to do in a week in one day, what are you going to do the rest of the 4 days, right? So you still, at the end of the day, you're going to spend the full week working, so you're going to find new ways to work on. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, yeah, it removes, at least it gives you, so the time you're working, a lot more meaning because you're achieving more, even you're spending the same time.
Yeah, there's certain, Anthony Hauck, who's one of the other people in our group, I think he has a really great way of summarizing this stuff to say, the things that we do give people more time. It doesn't necessarily give them more money or more creative expression or the ability to do less work. What we provide is the ability for people to spend their time in different ways, and how people decide to spend their time is totally up to them.
That's great.
At different stages of the game, we sort of say, like, you know, depending on who we're talking to, you know, if you're talking to the manager of an architecture office, you say, if you implement one of these methods, you will save all this money, because maybe that's the thing that is valuable to them. If you're talking to a designer, is it a discussion of, this will allow you to spend more time doing your creative design work?
I completely agree.
And at any one of these things, I would say that it does not necessarily make your life simpler.
No, but you have more time to focus, ideally, in thinking about what you're doing instead of just all the time executing and having to do a process that basically eats up your time, and you're kind of a slave of right. the process, rather than being able to kind of step back and say, okay, now I'm done with this. What's next? Or right. why am I doing this?
And one of the funny things also about these kind of processes is that they aren't new, in that it used to be that the people who were able to describe these sort of automated processes were not describing them to computers. They were describing them to either armies of underpaid interns, if you go farther back, to slaves. If you go, you know, a little bit further forward, it's, you know, is just describing it to robots. There's always been a role for people in describing systematic approaches to doing things. It's just a matter of who's executing that systematic approach. So there's probably like a whole Marxist digression we could do here on like seizing the means of production and that sort of thing.
Okay. So let's divert a bit. Let's talk a bit more about yourself, like outside of work.
Enough about me. Let's talk about me.
Let's talk about you. Yeah. So I'm always really interested in seeing like if people have like daily habits that they feel after years doing them that they have a positive impact. Like if you actually think that are things that you might do that you think maybe of an hour or 30 minutes a day or something that you've been experiencing for a while that they can really make a change or improvement in your life.
I guess there's a couple things that come to mind. I make sure that I wake up at least 15 minutes before anybody else in my house wakes up because, and I didn't even realize I was doing it until fairly recently, but it's a nice time to just sort of have some quiet before the day kicks off. The other one is a few years ago, I started running, which is, you know, some people do meditation or some people do yoga and all these other things. I think they're all kind of like a different slice of the same kind of habit of doing something that, you know, has your body and your mind sort of doing something that's sort of disconnected from the rest of the world. I find those things to be pretty valuable.
So do you play music when you're running? Or
I don't. Sometimes I do books on tape. I do them less and less. I'm listening to a friend of mine, Buck Sleeper, who works at Continuum next couple doors down, recently recommended Red Mars and Kim Stanley Robinson's books on Mars. And I've been listening to those on books on tape. And it's one of these books that I feel like it brings up lots of interesting ideas, which I keep turning off the book on tape because I would rather think about the ideas that it's bringing up than listen to the book. So that's sort of been a funny aspect of the books on tape when running. It sometimes become hard to focus on because it starts your brain working, and then your brain's really working really hard because it's getting oxygenated and all this stuff. And so there's plenty to sort of see and think about just running through the city.
I actually tried for myself like to run without music or anything, but if I do play something, I usually would play podcasts. Uh-huh. It's kind of more similar to like audiobooks than music. And yeah, I don't know why, but I just like to kind of use that time for something else, like to free my mind and think of my own kind of stuff, or have a podcast or something that you can think about.
Yeah, music also has like its own rhythm that is different than what it is that you're doing with your running. Or
yeah, I mean, I know some people would play like upbeat playlists to kind of keep the rhythm, but that's it's not. And do you have any bedtime rituals? So anything?
I don't anymore. I used to when I was really much more stressed out. I think in the very early days when we were making Dynamo, I had some real sleep trouble because it was very anxiety provoking. So I started doing this thing where I figured out how to force myself to sleep by I would take a song that I knew really, really well. And how did I do this? It was, I would take a song that I knew really well, and I would go through word by word through the song and visualize the words of each word in the lyric as I walked through the whole song. And before I got halfway through, I'd be asleep.
A kind of counting sheep, but
yeah, it was like a counting sheep. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I guess, I mean, the next question I wanted to ask you is like, how do you face boredom? Or if you even kind of think about that, like, I mean, just to specify what I mean, what would you do if boredom kicks in when you're doing something that you really wanted to do? You said like you've been like craving to do this one thing for months or for weeks or something, and then when you're doing it, you start getting bored of it and you think of something else. So kind of that distraction of the moment.
I guess yeah. If there's something that you're doing, like, you know, folding clothes or that sort of thing. Books on tape are actually pretty awesome for that, and it's kind of contrary, I think, in some ways to, I think, what this podcast is growing into be about, is like, you know, simplifying your life and mm-hmm. sort of what the sort of things are that you need to do to get through. I used to think before smartphones and all that, I used to wonder, are there sort of two ways for people to like go to the bathroom, for instance? You're sitting there on the toilet, you're doing your thing. Is this the appropriate time to be alone with your thoughts, or should you read a book? And I think that that's sort of part of like the whole sort of boredom thing. Like, you know, there are times when it's right to be sort of thinking about what's going on in the world, you know, because you're there and you're there in the moment. And then there's times where, okay, there's some emptiness going on right now and I need to fill it with entertainment or noise or music or you know, all the rest of the world. And I think that boredom is one of those things that I suspect that we're getting less skilled at dealing with as a people.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we're getting kind of engineered to like react to impulses every time that we're bored. Like we have something that we can do, and especially like turning to like news feed or Facebook feed or some kind of social media thing. So that's kind of what I've been also thinking about, like if there is a way that you need to, I mean, there is a meaning of those moments, right? Like those 5 minutes in between meetings or those maybe 10 minutes that you go on the subway, you don't necessarily need to be on the phone all the time, right? And those are the times when you can think about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly the, I go through this with my son. I have a 14-year-old boy who wants to be stimulated all the time, right? The worst thing in the world is the worst thing in the world is to be sort of stuck with nothing to do, you know?
Yeah, is that
that sort of that stillness, right? And I don't know. I when when I was growing up, we sort of had a lot of back and forth with Quaker practice around sort of, I don't know if you're familiar with. So one of the things in Quakerism is the idea of just being able to sort of sit quietly with your thoughts, either alone or in a group.
Is this some sort of meditation? Or
it's not really. I mean, I don't think it's pitched as a meditation, but it's just the value of sitting quietly in your community and sort of opportunities to sort of speak your mind about things that come up, but also the opportunity to sort of sit quietly with the rest of your community and just enjoy that sort of silence. Various ways that, like, I went to a Quaker college that had that as sort of, there was some aspects of that. And that's something that I think very few people would want to do anymore. And it's easy to sort of put all this under sort of like, oh, you know, this sounds like sort of like 70s meditation and stuff, whatever. But I think that there's lots and lots of different examples of the value of people being able to sort of sit quietly without anything else going on. And I think that that happens very little anymore. And I realize as I'm saying that, it sounds like, you know, kids these days.
Yeah, no, but no, but I mean, I think there is a lot of intrinsic power on trying to train yourself, even in those silly, right, like 5 minute moments, and not, they call it the delay of like gratification. Mm-hmm. So basically fighting the instant gratification moment where you're bored for a second and you say, okay, I have the impulse, and I'm just going to open my phone and look at whatever. You don't even know what it is. So just the fact of like saying, okay, I want to look at this feed, you know, but I'm going to do it because I want to do it. I'm going to do it in like 3 minutes after I finish this thing I'm doing right now. After those 3 minutes, you might not even remember, or you might not even care, because it was just a silly impulse that might divert your day from what you were doing. But I think that extrapolates to anything, like any project. So you're doing any side project that nobody's forcing you to do, but you decide to do, you're going to get bored, go to something else. And we're constantly jumping between things without like stopping. And I think it's worth thinking about it. I think there's moments where you actually should get and read the book. Like you get into that mindset of like, let's read the book, or let's use this time for doing this other thing. But there are times where we can just sit on the subway and just think about what the day is going to be or something like that, I believe. Okay, so one thing that relates to this is smartphones, or like social media, email, all that stuff. So what would you say is your relationship with social media?
So I used to do a lot more blogging, sort of, you know, more long-ish form writing. You know, mm-hmm. I guess it's funny thinking of it long form when you're talking about like 400 words or something. I'm a reasonably active Twitter person. I've never gotten into Facebook for whatever reason. I like Twitter. It's sort of a nice sort of pithy way to sort of share pointers. You know, if there's something that's more interesting, there's generally a link out to something that's more interesting. If it can be said in 140 characters, awesome. I'm gonna be like one of these curmudgeons who isn't into the 280 word Twitter feed, because it feels like it goes against. It's like haiku is a really nice format for poetry, I think, because haiku is a Japanese poetry format that's based on syllable count. You do 5 syllables and 7 syllables and 5 syllables. And the idea that you can get across a lot of information in a very terse amount makes you sort of edit and do that sort of thing. I think Twitter potentially can do the same thing with 140 characters, where you just need to, you know, choose your words carefully. And, you know, in order to get anything across, I kind of like that attitude. That aspect of social media I find compelling.
Yeah, so I mean, I wanted to know, so if you have any specific thing you like, you mentioned some already, and some things that you don't like about being so present, social media, or being...
Oh, boy. The things that that I don't like and I do like about social media? I love its ubiquity, and I can't stand its ubiquity, and it's... The thing that I think that we've all sort of become more aware of in the last year or 2 years is the sort of the bubble aspect of it, of, you know, that you end up in a hall of mirrors. It's really hard to, but I think it's really interesting and important to go and figure out ways to go and listen to people that you would not otherwise listen to. You know, we're in Boston in particular, we're in the, you know, lefty media central. It's very easy to find people that have your same worldview and perspective and just stay in that. And it's frustrating and maddening to go and look outside of that to hear other people's perspectives. But I think it's super important to do so. In Boston, it's super easy to just, you know, oh, we're all...
Yeah, stay in your bubble.
Yeah. You know, even this, the subject matter of this podcast, I'm sure, is incomprehensible to people outside of our bubbles. Yeah.
No, I mean, I also have this love-hate relationship with Twitter specifically. For instance, I barely use Facebook just to, like, publish some stuff, like, for example, things like this blog or other things I write online. But for Twitter, there are these kind of like episodes or like epochs, like parts of the week or the month or like the year that I engage a lot. And it feels like you have to be, it's really reactive, right? Like you see, you write something, people retweet it, and you're like constantly checking and stuff. And then there's like these 2 or 3 days that you just don't go back and there's nothing. And then you just can be like that for a month and you don't care about it.
What I do really like is that, especially in the last 2 years, I think, through Twitter, there's a whole bunch of people throughout the world that I've gotten to know that now when I run into them at conferences, it feels very odd that I've never met them in person.
Yeah, but you got a sense of like, oh, this, I know this person more, like it's familiar, right?
Yeah, and then when we run into each other in person, it's like, have we actually not met in person? That's, you know, because it feels like we have.
Yeah, that's happened
and
to me. It's,
getting those kind of relationships has been pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, and you end up like, you don't know who somebody is, but then you see the profile picture, you're like, oh yeah, I know who you are.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's interesting. I mean, it's a different way. And the field of, specifically the field of people that use like tools like Dynamo, Revit and stuff, and try to basically get into WhatsApp, and I am focusing developing at Autodesk. It's basically a really small community around the world. Like, mm-hmm. There might be, I don't know, like maybe 2,000 people on Twitter. It's not that many people that are actually active.
And we've also seen things like there's a whole sort of sub group of people who, you know, they're now, their careers have gone into different directions because of communities that are getting built on Twitter and on Dynamo. There's a group called, shout out to the Bad Monkeys, who were sort of early adopters of Dynamo, who, you know, really, and it's a, the Bad Monkeys is a group that is totally geographically dispersed. They're all over the world, a handful of people who are making computational design tools, involved in design work on the architecture engineering community, architecture engineering and construction communities. And they sort of coalesced out of a shared interest in making these kinds of tools and sort of overcoming the problems that we've put into the tools, whether purposely or accidentally. And they not only generated their own sort of set of friendships, but they've also generated a business, and they've generated a whole bunch of other relationships with other businesses. And that's been pretty exciting to see. And also just the idea that it's totally independent of us now, like nothing to do with us anymore.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You mentioned before your previous blog that I actually just Googled and found online. That was called like
abandoned
builds.blogspot.com. That's build with a Z at the end, builds. Yep. I would like you to read this quote and just tell me a bit of what you think about it, that is on the disclaimer at the bottom. Oh,
this is my Orson Welles disclaimer at the bottom. So just in context, most websites that, you know, purport to share any kind of information, which is what my old blog used to do, you know, have some kind of disclaimer, says, you know, you are, you know, you use these things at your own risk, blah, 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 blah. So I had that kind of thing. And then I found this quote from Orson Welles, which I thought was a really interesting disclaimer, which was, we're born alone, we live alone, we die alone. It's only through the love and friendship it is only through our love and friendship can we create the illusion for the moment that we are not alone. So that seemed like an interesting kind of disclaimer to me of saying, look, you're responsible for yourself. And it is wonderful that we can create these relationships of friendship and love. But remember that you are still yourself and you are responsible for yourself in that.
Yeah, no, I think like the part of like we're born alone, we live alone, we die alone is also like a thing to reflect according to like everything. Okay, so I also
I forgot. I put that in a long time ago. Yeah, it was also
I have the full disclaimer here.
Yeah, and then the full disclaimer is one that is derived from Autodesk's full disclaimer, which is disclaimers are hilarious. I don't know how many people actually like read the click-throughs.
I'll just read one sentence.
Sure.
It says Sacron and Builds do not guarantee that you will be able to successfully download or implement anything or any of the tips, tricks, examples, or suggestions outlined anywhere. So yeah, I mean, you can go to builds.blogspot.com, read the whole thing in the bottom of the page. So continuing a bit with the conversation of the smartphone, I also wanted to, because you had this analog to technology transition, I wanted to ask you, how do you deal with digital clutter? I mean, do you have digital clutter?
So I guess there's a couple ways. So one is just to sort of keep stuffing things in bags and then putting the bags in a drawer somewhere. I think one of my most systematic ways of accumulating digital clutter is I have one folder that I collect all of my screenshots in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just any time I use my screen grab,
put it in the same.
It all goes into the screenshot folder, and the screenshot tool automatically just labels something with a timestamp. Mm-hmm. And every year or so, in 2 weeks, I will take all of that and I will put it in the 2017 folder, and then that will be the archive for it. It will have 365 days worth of screenshots. And
okay.
They will just be stuffed into that area, and then I will move on to 2018. What's fun about that is that just that simple process of like accumulating these things becomes its own journal that you can sort of scroll back through. And it's a reasonably accurate record of what's happened during that year, because so much of what I'm doing is digital. And the stuff that isn't ends up getting in there anyway, because a lot of the photographs end up in the screenshot folder too.
Lately, I've been also, I do use this technique also for storing images and other things. I just, at the end of the day, chronologically, and then you just kind of archive folders. But there is an interesting thing I've been trying to do lately, because like all the things that we do on the computer are so volatile. Like you do something and the next day it's on the computer, might be uploaded somewhere, you might have submitted or even committed to GitHub or whatever you've done, but it's not tangible. You don't have an object in your table that reminds you that that's what you did yesterday. So I'm trying to do the same thing, but choose one screenshot or one GIF or something from every day of the work you've done. So keep a work log. Mm-hmm. So then you can come back and say, okay, what did I do for the last 2 weeks?
Do you print out anything?
Like physically?
Yeah.
Not too much. I mean, I like the idea of like, so if you have like your to-do lists or something on Trello or on your phone or something, I like the idea that, and I used to do this, to print it weekly and like have it on your wall. So you have some more connection to that and more presence, because otherwise it's just one more window in your computer and you don't really pay attention to it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I feel there should be more. I got this, I think it was Cal Newport in the book Deep Work. He actually mentioned the importance of having some sort of scoreboard, right? Like something that you can see, even if it's a digital screen or something, or you print it, but some sort of scoreboard that you can keep track of your performance, right? Like what you've done on the week or things like that, and kind of remind you like, okay, you're kind of progressing, you're doing things. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you close your computer and say, what did I do, right? You lose that sense of
But in terms of physical artifacts, I mean, there's an idea of like, you know, do you leave a trail?
I think I talked to you about this, like the kind of the same way that you think of art, right? Like kind of, you can tell us a bit more about that in a bit. Sometimes I would, so when I'm writing, for instance, I like to, it's a really silly thing because you can write the thing and read it on the same medium, but it kind of helps me have a different point of view if I export it to PDF and print it, or like export it to the Kindle, or like even if I visualize it on the web with a different typeface and kind of consume it in a different way. It kind of puts like some space between you, the creator, and you, the consumer of the thing. So I think that that is one way that I like the physical medium, or like the production of something, like production ready, let's say, or like a final outcome, because you get a sense that what you're doing is a bit more real. Like, for instance, what were you referring mainly?
Well, I'm thinking about it in relationship to your question of what do you do with digital clutter? Is that some people's ways of dealing with digital clutter is they also there is another aspect of making physical clutter. Physical clutter has obviously like all of its other problems associated with it. I have much more physical clutter from the things that I did before I became more digital.
Hmm.
You know,
I
used to do a lot of wet photography. And along with all the apparatus for making, you know, photographs, you've got all the photographs that now you got to keep somewhere. And my basement is full of all this stuff. And digital can become that too. And I think that in a lot of ways it's interesting and important to sort of externalize it, but then you got to keep it somewhere.
Yeah, I kind of felt, so the opposite way works better, I think. So Erin Dolan writes a blog called unclutter.com. Mm-hmm. And I really like a quote that she has on her book that she calls it picture perfect. And basically it's like for people who have a really hard time like letting go of things, if you have this thing that you've never used but it has emotional meaning or something like that, one thing that she says that you can take a picture of it, store it in your folder of like whatever folder you want, and then just keep that picture instead of the physical item, right?
Do you have your models from graduate school?
I've thrown them away, almost all of them. I think back in Spain, they're like a lot of them. They're still there, but yeah, the only one I 3D printed that was kind of smaller and it's a bit more detailed, that thing I will keep. But all the other ones are like cardboard paper and stuff. I kind of
You kept the one that was a digital, that was a physical representation of a digital model.
Yeah, it actually took more effort than it seems. Like, even though it was 3D printed, but.
But then the handcrafted stuff.
The handcrafted. I mean, I have kept the ones that are like balsa wood, the ones that are actually like more refined in terms of like sanding or like a bit more care, but the ones that are like made with paper or cardboard and stuff like that, they suffer more with time and they look awful after years. So on foam board turns like yellow. Mm-hmm. So I got rid of a lot of those. But again, like if you take a good pictures of those models, you're gonna end up revisiting those pictures more and show to people than actually going to your house and showing them the model. So I don't know. I mean, I think there is, I wouldn't say like I would print or like generate products to like store them, but more to have them more present, right? Like if you have, what do you think of art? Like you mentioned a couple of days ago, I think, that you see that as a daily object that we just have to kind of.
Well, the idea of the physical object, hey, we could get into Walter Benjamin. let's not do that. The idea of sort of the daily kind of practice, there's a group that I worked for a little while called the Bread and Puppet Theater that has the founder of it, Peter Schumann, has a bunch of different manifestos about art and art production, and the one that I think is particularly great is something called the Cheap Art Manifesto, which is, you know, sort of that art is something that you sort of make and produce and you can put on your kitchen, and on your refrigerator, and you have it around and you use it in your daily life and you are not precious about it and it might get consumed. If you make a make a nice thing, you can use it as a coaster. Put it on your table and then you see it and you rest your coffee on it and eventually it gets consumed by the ring and that kind of thing. And then you let it go, which I think is a pretty great way to think about this stuff. And it's different than, you know, art is stuff that you sort of preserve. And, you know, I suppose there's places for both of them, but I like pottery.
Pottery
is kind of a nice aspect of that because it's rooted in this sort of daily use aspect, and is beautiful and can be handcrafted and can be consumed and eventually turns back into dirt.
The cool thing about art to me, it's that you can give it away and you can make an artifact that you like, but after a while you're going to kind of get bored of it. Either way, right? Like, it depends. If it's something that's really useful, it starts being more a utility than art. But if it's just art, for example, I did recently some stickers, right? So I ordered stickers and I was like giving them away. And that actually makes me happier. I mean, it's just a way to kind of have joy through something that you've done and you're kind of giving away as a gift. But I have this kind of... So I have some attachment to certain things I sketch, even if they're doodles, and then I end up scanning and maybe vectorizing. So the main form it ends up living in is on the digital medium, but I have some kind of need to kind of store those and keep them. So that's kind of, so we also recently talked about some people like to keep books, but I prefer having them digitally because I don't see the point of owning a lot of physical books. But I guess my own paper is like physical paper that you use for sketching, right? Like, I value each sketch or each drawing as something unique that you might preserve or give away, but I would have a hard time like throwing them away after scanning them. Yes, right. So I think that's the only thing that is gonna pile up over time on my wardrobe. I think I have like 3 or 4 cardboard boxes with all my sketchbooks from architecture school back in Spain.
Right.
So I think, I mean, there is some physical attachment to that artifact, right? Other thing is that you just want to give it away or get rid of it. I don't know.
Right. I've had my workspace here at the office is sort of cluttered with 3D prints of a lot of things.
Pretty cool.
And there are ones that have survived longer than others, but invariably something just gets knocked off the table and, you know, gets crushed. And it's kind of nice because it makes room for the next thing. there's been a lot. And then some of those fragments become more interesting and stick around.
I think this is something I was going to forget to mention, but I think there's also some freedom to when you have the physical drawing or doodle, right? And you scan it and process it on the computer. And then you have like, maybe you prepare it to do a letterpress print or like a digital print. Once you have that production file, you're kind of relieved that that thing is permanent on the, you know, it's on the cloud store or it's on your computer and you can generate as many as you want. So if you print one, you can read it. So I guess in 3D printing is that kind of, you know, you have that STL file. STL files are the basically all the definition of a geometry to be 3D printed. So you have that kind of impermanence of that object that even if you break it or something, you know that there might be another printer that can duplicate that object. So you kind of, I mean, I can see how you might not care that much about a 3D printed object, but like a pottery that you've done once and it's like a unique piece.
Right. Yeah. So I started 3D printing ceramic. Shapeways has a pretty great interface for that. And I still can't quite figure out how they're making them. But it's funny because they're precious in that, you know, they're shiny and they're nice and, you know, they have a heft to them and, you know, they can be around in your daily life. And they're precious because they're a little expensive. Like, I have a mug that was like $120 to get printed. And it's absolutely not unique. I mean, it has a little bit of uniqueness to it because it depends on sort of how the, you know, glaze particularly settles on it. So it's sort of notionally unique, but in reality, not really. And so its preciousness it's interesting because it is 100% precious in financial terms.
Yeah.
Not in terms of uniqueness. And I think that that's a really Okay, so I will do Walter Benjamin. So,
go.
The work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, if you haven't read it, is worth reading for anybody who is making stuff. And this was, when did he write these things? It was like 1920s, 1930s. He talks about the difference between what is an artwork when you can make multiple versions of it. And, you know, there's sort of the change from something being sort of having this gravity to it when it's the only one that could possibly exist versus it's something that can have its own magic and amazement and shares some unique view of the world or shares some idea, but is absolutely not precious in terms of its uniqueness. And that is a change that happened in the last century. And a lot of that was around, you know, photography and printmaking techniques and that sort of thing. And the cool thing about doing ceramic 3D prints is it really feels like this way that that we're in that situation sort of in another way. It's not really fundamentally different, but it allows our my generation, at least, to sort of experience something that feels precious and feels built and feels unique and substantial, but is absolutely not unique.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm debating also this because me and my mom are actually like starting to put some of our art online, basically to sell it. And there is also a debate on, I mean, when you buy something, there's one thing that the amount of money you pay for it makes it more precious for you to value. You're not going to take as much care as you're going to take of a $1,000 phone of like a $50 or like $150 flip-flop phone, right? But I think there is intrinsic value of when you go through a crafty process that produces, you know, like an object that you yourself would like, you know, like this 3D printed object that is kind of, I mean, has a nice materiality to it compared to like just a FDM like plastic printer. And it happens the same way with art. Like if you make a reproduction that is done through letterpress with like good paper, it's not the same that just printing the same thing on like 80 grams paper, right? So I think there is like a mixed like perception value of how much, I mean, because here we're talking about price and then the kind of the quality of the end object, but there is another factor that always happens is like how much effort do you put into the thing, right? How much time do you invest? Like there might be somewhere in the world that is a professional and might do this thing in 50 minutes. And you might have taken like a month to right. do it. So you're going to have a hard time getting rid of that thing.
And it's also, I mean, like with the idea of, you know, sort of designers now can start doing the things that sort of the master designer, the principal have been able to do in terms of like describing a system and having mm-hmm. a computer execute it rather than a mountain of servants. Again, this is not a problem that was new even to the last century, but, you know, I went to this crazy New Year's party years ago where somebody had this apartment like right on Central Park, real run-in with wealth, where I got off the elevator that opens in their penthouse apartment, and walked down the hallway and was confronted with an Albrecht Dürer print, who is like sort of one of my favorites. and I was sort of walking around and I looked around the corner and was like, holy shit, that's a Dürer. And, you know, looking at it really closely, and it's beautiful and it's intricate and it's just sort of like sitting on this person's mantle. And on one level, it's, you know, that's a super precious thing. And it's, you know, it's beautiful and it's rare and it's exquisite and it's, but it's not unique. And there's a plate somewhere mm-hmm. probably where yeah. you could make more of them. And I don't know. I there's no conclusion from that, but I think that we're in another sort of inflection point in that kind of way of thinking about what is unique and what is unique to you, mm-hmm. What is unique to everybody's experience.
Yeah, I'm not gonna get into like a whole discussion of like where machines are going to undervalue art or things like that, but we're gonna see also probably a transition between how much people is valuing art, right? Like end pieces of art and like what machine learning and like new computer algorithms are gonna be able to achieve. One example is basically style transfer, where like the Berkeley University, like the research of artificial intelligence lab, published one of the first papers last November 2016, I think, where like they're starting to make programs that can copy the style of an artist and like place it on top of your
right.
portrait, right? So how is that? I mean, in some ways, like the ability of being able not to only reproduce copies, but to generate, right, something from scratch, just from a from an image or something. So it's also, I mean, I think there will always be some intrinsic value of the handmade, you know, by someone. Like even there is like a letterpress shop close to my house in Cambridge, and they have this kind of like the, what was it? The resistance is handmade. That's kind of their...
Right.
And it's because like all these things you can automate or like send online, but at the end, if you order like a handmade letterpress, there is some, I don't know, there is something that you're paying for, right? Like the thing that there is, there might be imperfections or the process is more manual.
Right. The another good book on this is Neal Stephenson's Diamond Age, which is it's a science fiction book that says, you know, what happens when essentially replicators, you know, matter replicators have sort of become real and we can on demand sort of have the things that satisfy all of our needs. And one of the things that he sort of posits in the book is the reemergence of a bunch of different sort of value systems and production systems that are essentially made obsolete by this technology sort of come and rise again because of the freedom that people have from actually producing the goods that they need to stay alive. So for instance, this reemergence of a whole Victorian class and a Victorian methods for making goods, like everything from soap to paper to all this stuff, that once people sort of don't have to have anything, the things that they end up wanting are the ones that are imbued with labor or morality, or it's an interesting book because it imagines a whole. Neal Stephenson does a great job of sort of world building, and that's one of the things that he does a world building exercise around is, you know, what happens in abundance.
Okay, before we close this part, so are there any physical objects that you're attached to that you're always thinking, should I trust this thing or not?
My house.
Your house? Entire house?
Yeah, we have regular conversations of like, oh, the faucet's leaking. We should burn the house down and move.
Okay, so we've talked a bit about this already, but do you have any specific techniques or any specific ways that you try to disconnect? So from, I don't know, from mainly from your phone or from like communication or from what you usually do, there's any, I don't know, it might be physical or like just technological.
The best thing about plane rides, I think, is that they have the potential for not being connected. Like more and more they are connected. I've sort of started pretending like they aren't.
Yeah.
Because then you I can get on and not be plugged in.
You don't want to tell people, oh, I have free Wi-Fi on my plane.
Right. It's like, no, sorry, there's no Wi-Fi on the plane. When people like lose their phones or have lost their internet connection, I always feel like I need to say congratulations.
It's so I even forgot about this, but I just bought an iPhone. So my first smartphone was in 2016. I'm so technologically whatever,
did you have like a
right?
flip phone or something?
No, I had a flip phone. Well, I had like a Nokia 101 that is one of these like black and white that you only can call and text SMS.
You're probably really good at Snake now.
Right? Yeah, they had like the new Snake. It was really bad. So, but what happened to me is like I bought. From someone in my class, I bought like an iPod Touch in 2008, and I think I've owned 5 different iPod Touches. And the thing with iPod Touch is like, yeah, it lets you do everything, like everything that you can do with your phone, but you don't have internet anytime you're on the go, right? Like if you're traveling or if you're going out, if you're going to the store, to a local store, whatever, you have those moments of forced disconnection. And what happened to me is like people knew it. People knew I wouldn't use Facebook Messenger or anything, that I would use email, but I would basically respond in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever. So people would just call you. And I think there is basically something powerful there that you kind of have to lie to yourself that, oh, I can't. I don't know. Like I had recently my phone didn't have, like the battery was broken. And that was a way for me to use my phone less, right? It was a kind of a, there are different ways that people do it, but.
You're free.
Well, no, I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's things that we need to tell ourselves and kind of self-enforce. I know that some people have certain rooms of the house that they kind of say, okay, this is like phone free or things like that. But
well, I mean, on the other side of it is like, you know, there is a whole, you know, vast swaths of America, of human history where you were never alone and you never had access to the idea of private space is really recent. And the idea of that you're always in the soup is probably more dominant in, you know, the history of the species than not. You know, always being surrounded by, you know, if you're an urban dweller, you know, 500 years ago, did you have private space? Did you have the ability to sort of turn off? I mean, in a lot of ways, the idea of privacy and silence is sort of a monastic and privileged idea, you know, that not most people do not have the luxury of being able to get to choose their quiet.
I mean, it's a powerful thing that we can do today, actually. I mean, you can put your phone on airplane mode if you're in an important meeting or you're going to take an exam. And that justification, I don't know, if you have to take like an English test for an exam or something, they say, oh, you need to turn off your phone, whatever. That person is telling you something that you can do any day, right? You can tell everyone one day, I'm going to shut my phone for 3 hours because I have to write this thing. But we rarely do it, right? But then when we have this thing like getting into a plane, the world doesn't end, but we're like 3 hours or 6 hours without internet and there's no problem. Okay, so I'm gonna just do before we start wrapping up, I'm gonna start doing like a few quick questions.
Sure.
And
I think on Designalize, this was called, which also is a hilarious podcast if you haven't heard it, Designalize by Brian Ringley and Zach Downey, which I don't think they've done one in a year, but they had the lightning round.
Okay, yeah, this is similar. I know, like, Tim Ferriss also does a lightning round. It's kind of a common thing. Okay, so what's your take on clothing?
I wear it so I don't get arrested. I don't have my, I guess my fashion is practical. Okay. I've worn relatively the same thing since the early 80s, I think. Which my wife gets on me about. It's like, why are you wearing those pants from 85? It's like, oh, they're the same pants.
Oh. So how do you distribute? I mean, would you say you have some kind of technique or to distribute your money or like to track how much you spend or like kind of to be accountable for what you do, or you feel like it's better kind of to let go a bit?
I feel really lucky that I don't have to track it very well. You know, the checks clear at Autodesk. It's nice. I think we don't spend our money on a lot of different things. We're ridiculous about food, but I think that one of the things that we do in my family is we try and make sure that we don't have to think about money very much by not spending it.
Okay. So is there one thing that you can name that makes your days a bit more complex than they could be?
What makes my life more complex than it should be?
That it could be. I mean, if you didn't have that thing, just
that would make it less complex.
Hard one.
Commuting. I mean, commuting is a big thing. It's just like
I was thinking exactly.
We kind of. I feel like we've adjusted ourselves to think like, you know, it's okay that like 2 hours out of the day is going to be dedicated to moving around. Or I mean, I don't know. 2 hours a day. Some people have a lot more than that. Some people have less. But the idea of, you know, if you've got 16 hours a day, say that you're awake and you're going to take an eighth of that.
And if you wake up
to move your body from one place to another.
Yeah. And if you wake up like 1 hour later, you might be having to squeeze with like a lot of people.
Right.
That's something I really hate. I try to wake up really early, so there's no one there, but it's hard. Do you have any tricks for light traveling? Basically, like traveling light with not a lot of stuff. Or
yeah, don't give yourself a very big bag.
Don't put slack, right? Don't give you more space than you might need.
Yeah. If you travel with a big bag, you'll fill it up. Yeah. I actually really like packing.
Packing?
That was for some reason.
Is there, what would you say to your 20 or 30 year old self? Anything that you think would help?
I am 30. No. Just kidding. What would I say to my 20 or 30 year old self that would help? I can't think of anything pithy off the top of my head.
Okay. Is there anything you can think of that you self-impose to yourself, like a restriction? Something that you say, I kind of have the impulse to do, but I would prefer not to. I'm going to kind of change that behavior or something.
I think I would probably be drinking coffee constantly through the day if I didn't just tell myself not to.
Do you like it, or is it because of caffeine? Or
I just like this, like the warmth.
The warmth that you like.
The habit of that. Bourbon. I really like bourbon, too.
Okay, I ran out of questions, so
stop with my statement about bourbon. Terrible.
Okay, so is there anything that you would like to say before we start wrapping up? Anything?
No, I'm really looking forward to the conversations that you're going to be having in this podcast. I always really enjoy talking with you about these things because your particular interests sort of span this idea between handcraft and digital craft and thinking about it and not thinking about it. I think that these are all
questions. I think there is something that we need to also, and these are conversations that I also have with my mom and with some friends like Jose Luis. And basically, we need to also embrace, right, this digital era and try to take what is positive about it, right? A lot of people get clammed with saying like, oh, I need to do this sketch really well by hand because it's a hand sketch. I just want to put contrast on the computer. But you have Photoshop, so maybe, I mean, I'm not saying that you should cheat, but you should give you some kind of, say, of like, relax. I mean, you can fix this later. Just enjoy now, enjoy the drawing, and then take the benefit of the digital part later, right? Like, kind of have a balance between the two mediums. I mean, really thank you for being in the podcast. So this has been the second episode, and
an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Okay, and before we go, I will ask you to say, so where can people find you? And
I'm on Twitter at Zach Kron, ZACHKRON. That's probably the best place to hit me. Happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay, cool. And I'll try to put as many things as Zach and I have been referring to on the podcast on the episode notes. I would also encourage you to visit dynamobean.org. That is basically the blog where Zach and the whole team try to communicate the news of Dynamo and kind of shape the vision of where we think that digital software should go to make, I mean, I wouldn't say easier, but make the lives of a lot of designers a bit more, how would you say?
I think putting more ideas into the things that we make.
Okay, cool. So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Well, that was the second episode of the Getting Simple podcast. Before you go, I'd like to remind you that you can visit a detailed list of episode notes at gettingsimple.com/podcast/2 for episode number 2. You can also join Getting Simple at gettingsimple.com/subscribe. Consider rating our podcast on iTunes, as this is the best way for other people to find about it.
Thanks a lot for listening, and see you in the next episode.